And welcome back to the second hour of this 9/11 truth. Truth out on the radio. Today we're going to be promoting the 6th annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival. And that's coming up this weekend. And that's going to be September 10th and 11th. And the 12th. It's going to be Thursday through Sunday. And it's going to be in Oakland, in San Francisco, and San Leandro. It's a wonderful film festival. My next guest is going to be speaking at it. And you can get all the information for the 9/11 Truth Festival at sf911truth.org. And my next guest, Mickey S. Huff, is now the director of Project Censored. Mickey, are you there?
I am here.
All right. Great to have you. Thanks for your time, Mickey.
No, thanks for having me on. Much appreciated.
Thank you. You, Mickey, your Project Censored is a big deal in the progressive community. And in introducing yourself to the folks, why don't you go ahead and touch on that a little bit? So why don't you tell us, just introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a little bit about Project Censored, which you're now the director of, you just became.
Right. This spring, Project Censored is the oldest media research group in the United States, the oldest contiguously existing. It was founded in 1976 by communications professor Carl Jensen in response to media failures and queries about the Watergate scandal and the aftermath, principally critiquing corporate media and looking at how alternative non-corporate and independent voices were actually spearheading more of a muckraking tradition. And Professor Jensen turned it into an annual research project looking at the most undercovered or underreported stories. And he did that for 20 years before the project was taken over by Dr. Peter Phillips, a sociologist at Sonoma State University. And Peter had been the director until this past year when I took over. Peter and I have worked together for several years. We've worked together on a variety of media censorship issues. And I was associate director for 2 years, published with Paul Ray and some others in the 2009 book, co-edited and co-authored the 2010 book. And our new book, Censored 2011, is out this week. We hope to have copies of it at the film festival. And we're growing as an anti-censorship organization. We have, in the 2010 book, we spent time in one of the chapters talking about the attacks against or critiques of Project Censored, that we were right or left-leaning or what have you, and we basically did an analysis of our work over the past 16 years, looking at how we cover stories under a variety of administrations from a variety of views. Our prism is media censorship and underreported stories that matter most to the public. So if we have a bias, that's it. We're in favor of a free press, we're in favor of free inquiry, and we're an anti-censorship organization. So we are spearheading that into the 21st century in an era where truth-telling in major media is a few and far between type of experience. And we actually, Peter Phillips and I both consider the state that we're living in presently, particularly in the United States, is a literal truth emergency, where there's a yawning gap between the beliefs of the public at large and the myths and propaganda propounded by corporate media versus the factual reality around us.
And one might, Mickey Huff, one might say, well, look, you know, you guys want to look into the media. Apparently you say it's been corporatized. Well, you know, hey, look, they're going to have baseball games, sports is going to go on, life's going to go on, your kid's going to go to school. But at this point in time for this country, we've been at perpetual war since 2002, correct?
Well, we've actually been at war pretty much most years since the country was founded, and we've been at war most, the last declared war, as if that matters anymore. The last officially declared war, of course, was World War II in 1941. It's of course your assessment is very accurate and fair to say we have been at war. It's the so-called global war on terrorism, or the Orwellian war on terror, that's been ongoing and unabated since, despite the doublespeak claims of withdrawing troops and downsizing. It's again a major shell game to cover up the hegemonic goals of the American empire.
Mm-hmm. And what you've delved into with the media blackout, so to speak, could lead us into even more perpetual war that could take this country right over the edge and into a place that a country hasn't been since maybe Nazi Germany or Chile in 1973 or several other countries I can think of.
Yeah, and I mean, and that, historically, analogically, it's often difficult to make pure connections. And granted, anytime people mention other examples, other eras, other events, I mean, there's a tendency for distortion. So try not to do so much of the historical analogy business, and really just try to deal with the facts at hand in the present. Although history, of course, is a great teacher. I'm an assistant professor of history at Diablo Valley College, so that's certainly an occupational hazard of mine, history as context for framing the present. Of course, Paul Ray and I wrote a whole article on that whole issue called Deconstructing Defeat and the Role of Media in Censorship, looking through the prism of 9/11. But you could do it, and Project Censored has done this, through a variety of different subjects and topics over the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get to that article you guys wrote together. It's called, like you said, Deconstructing Deceit, 9/11, the Media, and Myth Information, M-Y-T-H, myth. I love that phrase you guys came up with for that. And I want to read a couple of paragraphs because these struck me real, real solid. I think this hit the nail on the head. Quoting now from the article from Paul Ray and Mickey Huff, the mainstream corporate media and even the progressive press have repeatedly endorsed the government-sponsored official story formalized in the 9/11 Commission report. This narrative tells us that 19 Islamic extremists conspired and outwitted the best defended country in the world because government agencies ignored many pre-warnings. These terrorists were able to catch American defenders by surprise, hijack four airliners, and ram three of them into targets symbolic of American economic and military might. But is this the full true story? Are there other narratives that square better with the evidence? Are significant details being ignored? These are not questions that the American news media have asked or encouraged the public to ask. Residents from the news media, both corporate and independent, have effectively prevented adequate reportage, fact-based both discussions, and in-depth analysis of 9/11. This paradoxical suppression has made the full story of 9/11 a recurring concern in the publication of Project Censored. And I'd like to go on just a little bit. In fact, some pundits have actively attacked those who challenge the official story of 9/11 as if they were blasphemers or continue to rely upon strong religious overtones in defense of American mythology and government-endorsed interpretations of 9/11. MSNBC, and here's a great accounting you mentioned in the article, MSNBC's Tucker Carlson exemplified what you're talking about here, this tendency, during an interview with 9/11 scholar and theologian Dr. David Ray Griffin. On the program, Tucker Carlson attacked the professor for challenging the official narrative of 9/11. As soon as Dr. Griffin claimed he rejected the government's explanation for the events of 9/11, Carlson interrupted and attacked, and he said, quoting, "It is wrong, blasphemous, and sinful for you to suggest, imply, or help other people come to the conclusion that the U.S. government killed 3,000 people. Of its own citizens, because it didn't kill them. In this case, as in many others, the interviewer attacked even the prospect of discussion concerning alternative ideas about 9/11 before it began, thus framing the rest of the interview and reinforcing the official myths of 9/11. Here, we arrive at a crucial corollary. Media myth-making discourages pluralistic perspectives on reality and thus involves a form of censorship." I'm quoting from Mickey Huff and Paul Ray's article. Mickey, can you speak on that?
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that is ongoing. Any form of tampering, attacking, labeling, framing is a form of propaganda, i.e. censorship, of getting at what's really going on. And this doesn't mean that we have preordained conclusions on one angle or another. It just simply means that we'll have open debate in a free press. And we clearly don't have that. I mean, it's very obvious that any time this comes up in the press at all, it's basically lampooned. It's mocked, essentially. I mean, to be just quite literal about it. David Ray Griffin, who was mentioned in that article, wrote an article called "Left-Leaning Despisers of the 9/11 Truth Movement: Do You Really Believe in Miracles?" That's posted at globalresearch.ca from this past summer, July 6th. I urge people to read that article as well, because it's an open letter to people on the left that have been openly hostile to 9/11 researchers by using straw person, red herring, and ad hominem attacks and fallacies to distort what people like Paul Ray or Jim Hoffman or Stephen Jones or David Ray Griffin and Richard Gage and others are actually doing. And the Project Censored is not a 9/11-centric organization. And in fact, I mentioned earlier what our bias is in favor of a free press, but many have referred to us as a progressive organization over the years, and we've taken our lumps over our support of 9/11 inquiry over the years, with some judges resigning and so forth. I mean, people trying to boycott some things we were doing. We got slammed in the Santa Rosa Press Democrat because then-director Peter Phillips had the audacity to invite a physics professor to a university to talk about his theories concerning 9/11. I mean, one would think that that would be one of the last bastions of inquiry and free speech at the university, and we had the free press and people at Sonoma State University just lashing out at the very notion that somehow someone would give Dr. Stephen Jones a platform to espouse his views. I mean, again, it's as if Voltaire didn't exist 2 centuries ago. The idea that we're supposed to be defending the right of all peoples in a free society to express their views, particularly these that are of academic relevance and significance, connected to deeply important recent historical events. I mean, if you can't have either the free press allowing this debate to happen and you don't have the higher education system allowing this debate to happen, democracy is a joke. Freedom is a myth. And I think one of the central tenets of the article that Dr. Ray and I put together was misinformation, which, of course, sounds a lot like misinformation, but mythological historical narratives are quite misleading. And we wind our way through the U.S. history, in particular foreign policy history and false flag histories and so forth. You know, America as a country of suffering from historical amnesia. We run from the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, II, Vietnam. I mean, all these major wars and incidents in our past were all based on false events, false flag events, bogus information, all the way up through WMDs in Iraq. So I think that this is a real problem, both our inability as a culture to address factual matters and respectfully disagree, as well as be unaware of the past, about how these pasts set precedent, quite literally. And I know that Paul's new book coming out next year has a whole chapter addressing that, building off of the article that we did together. And I urge people to be more familiar with it and to not shy away from having these kinds of debates, especially in the so-called progressive left community, where this is supposed to be a sacrosanct issue, freedom of expression, freedom of press, and so forth. So I would like to see much more openness within the left movements and progressive movements at dealing with fact-based and transparent 9/11 scholars and researchers, where they're not called conspiracy theorists, where they're not labeled pejoratively, or they're not actually on not the left, but the liberal center or the liberal right center. Obama's Harvard appointee, Cass Sunstein, calling to infiltrate 9/11 truth movement to discredit them and break them up and these kind of things. I mean, this is a total return to COINTELPRO. And to see even centrist liberals supporting such absolute violations of the First Amendment is atrocious and disgraceful. And if this is the kind of hope and change Obama brought forward, we have come nowhere since the dark days of the Bush years.
You're listening to Mickey Huff, Associate Professor of History at Diablo Valley College, and now Director of Project Censored Media Freedom Foundation. And you can get Project Censored's information at projectcensored.org. You can get Mickey Huff at Mickey, you got your own website too?
Yeah, well, I could be emailed, mickey@projectcensored.org. We have projectcensored.org. We also have our university affiliates program website. We have over 30 colleges and universities helping us do research now around the globe. That's at mediafreedominternational.org. And we also have a blog at the Daily. It's called thedailycensored.com. So I urge people to go and check out our work at those sites, pre-order the 2011 book, or if you happen to live in the Bay Area, please come out to the Grand Lake Theater this Thursday, the 9th. Peter and I are both giving keynote addresses. I'll also be at the Ball Theater in San Leandro the evening of September 11th, and Peter Phillips and I will also be at the legendary City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco at the corner of Columbus and Broadway. That'd be the evening Thursday, the 16th. So we'd love to meet people. We love when folks come out. We like to meet our readers. We like to meet our critics. Again, we're very anti-censorship and pro-free speech, so we encourage people to come out and engage in cultural dialogue, political dialogue, and live up to, again, our civic principles ensconced in the Constitution.
As we were talking on that last segment, Tucker Carlson used the word blasphemous against Dr. David Ray Griffin, who's a theologian and a scholar and has written the real definitive books on this 9/11 mm-hmm. subject. And it strikes me funny that when folks from the right wing, and we see it now with this Islamic Cultural Center mm-hmm. controversy in New York, and it turns out that in Florida this coming weekend on the 11th, there might be a Quran burning down in Florida at a church.
Right, and even General Petraeus has come out opposed to that, saying that that would be a really dumb thing to have happen.
Well, yeah, just think of an Islamic country had a Bible burning somewhere in the world.
Yeah, well, we probably would invade them in short order.
Yeah, Paul Ray said the same
thing. Not that we're a theocracy, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And what strikes me funny is why a news commentator would use such a kind of a religiously based term as blasphemous, like, don't
right.
you blaspheme in here. We're in a TV studio, buddy. We're not in a church.
Yeah. The irony is astounding, but for people like Carlson and many others in the corporate media, they're paid shills. They're propagandists. They're not real journalists. In fact, many of them have even admitted that in private interviews, including Sean Hannity, who publicly announced he was an American first and a journalist second, and if his, you know, whatever he could do as a journalist to reinforce his ideas of patriotic nationalism was his duty. And again, so that's a direct public admission that these people are paid shills and propagandists, whether it's you don't have to go looking under the surface for the AstroTurfers at Koch Industries and the rest of these places for the, you know, for the big right-wing money behind the Tea Parties and these kind of things. But I think that, again, to be very strictly serious, again, the irony is astounding. But, you know, we just have to turn off the corporate media. They're not in the business of news. They're in the business of trying to shape public opinion. And, you know, as you, of course, may be well aware, and, as, of course, as some of your listeners may also be aware, you know, this has been a managed news country for going on the better part of a century, really starting with the Creel Commission and the Committee on Public Information, going back to World War I, 1916, where Eddie Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, wrote this a decade later in a book literally called Propaganda, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country." So Bernays is essentially foreshadowing Tucker Carlson, Fox News, the Republican Party, Roger Ailes taking over the Fox newsroom, Koch Industries behind the astroturfing, and so on. This is all a mirage designed to distort reality and to further elitist hegemonic ends. Also something written about 50 years ago by C. Wright Mills in The Power Elite in 1956. So this stuff isn't even new. Historian Daniel Boorstin wrote about it in 1961 and 2 called Pseudo-Events in American History, and he specifically talked about the new press conference and televised idea of the press conference as a managed news event, as a total spectacle of American propaganda. So again, there's a long history of this kind of information control in this country, and we can see it unfortunately unraveling right before us in real time. So this is again one of the missions of Project Censored, is to deconstruct, decode, and to really give an antidote to the truth emergency. And we do validated independent news reporting where we have faculty and students researching these kinds of news stories and alternative independent news stories and then we publish them on our websites, and we say, well, we've had experts fact-check this. Can there be mistakes? Sure. But we're going through the process of validating this kind of news and giving people a chance to go and look for non-corporate news. You can go to censorednews.org off the Project Censored site, which has our daily RSS feeds of non-corporate news feeds. And there's more than 50 news stories a day. That's more than you'll get in the New York Times. You can go to one place to get it. So again, this isn't just about 9/11, but we think 9/11 is a big part of our current state of affairs. And we're not going to shy away from it just because people call us names, tinfoil hats, and conspiracy theorists. Instead, those are all fallacies designed to prevent people from actually thinking independently.
Does it worry you, Mickey, when you see the right-wing media machine that's manipulated all this, like you just mentioned, using religion as almost like a weapon or a club?
Sure. It's been going on for decades. Again, you know, Sinclair Lewis wrote in the 30s, mm-hmm. you know, when fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross. I mean, this also is nothing new. It's, of course, worrisome, and it's a worrying trend, to be sure. But I think the antidote to this trend is critical independent thought and an actual free press, rather than having the corporate media be turned into some kind of, you know, theocratic soapbox.
Right.
That can be dangerous. They foment the whole business in the Tea Party movement, where they foment all this anger and resentment over falsities and false events and rumors and factless claims. And then they lump 9/11 truthers in the middle of these false claimed examples from birthers and the rest of these kind of labeling folks they have. And so that's also done to discredit people. And I know a lot of people on the left do not get involved in a lot of 9/11 research because it is associated with paleoconservatism, libertarianism, and so forth among some adherents. And I know that pushes people on the left away. But I'm suggesting that shouldn't push people away. What we should do is look at things on their face. People should look at the evidence that Stephen Jones and Richard Gage have written, have produced. They should look at arguments of Paul Ray. They should look at discussions about media manipulation, and they should use that as a platform to begin to think for themselves.
Very well put, Mickey S. Huff, director of Project Censored Now, and also associate professor of history at Diablo Valley College. You'll be speaking this coming weekend, at starting Thursday, at the 9/11 Truth, the 6th annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival, which will be held in Oakland, San Francisco, and San Leandro. And you're going to be, I guess, at all three events at different times, right?
I'll be in Oakland and San Leandro, not San Francisco.
Oh, I'll miss you there. But I'm going to come and see you at City Lights for sure.
That'll be the 16th.
Yeah, but sometime in the fall, Mickey, we're going to have to do another show. You and I will have to do another show on the new Project Censored book.
Can't wait.
Me neither. Mickey, I want to thank you for all your great work, and it's been great meeting you over this interview, and we're going to continue this at a later date, okay?
Thanks so much, Bird. Much appreciated. Look forward to seeing you and some of your listeners this week.
Thank you. You have a great weekend.
You too.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Mickey S. Huff, director of Project Censored. He'll be back on these airwaves within the next couple of months, and we'll go over that book, Project Censored's brand new book, all the stories that you need to know about if you want to get through this next time, because the truth matters, even if it hurts sometimes. Coming up, an on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground activist in the 9/11 truth movement, Mr. Dana Carson, in the studio live with me right here at KZSU Stanford. Stand by. Okay, coming back at you now, I want to thank Kai Middleton of the 9/11 Truth Movement for setting up all the guests today on this show. My name is Bird, your host, and this is the show normally heard in this time slot. It's called Shedding Lights, and we just try to shed light on different subjects. And today, we're helping to promote and bring about awareness of the 9/11 Truth Movement. And the 9/11 Truth Movement is a gathering of folks from all walks of life who didn't believe the story we were told after 9/11 as to what happened, and the 6th Annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival will be happening this coming weekend, Thursday through Sunday, all around the Bay Area. You can go on sf911truth.org to get the whole schedule. And right now, described to me before we met as a boots-on-the-ground activist, Mr. Dana Carson is in the studio. Dana, how you doing today?
Just fine. Great to meet you, Bird.
Nice to meet you. Now, briefly introduce yourself to the folks and give us a feel as to how you came to be involved in the 9/11 Truth Movement. But who are you and where you're from?
Well, my name is Dana Carson. My degrees in college are master's and bachelor's in geology, which has very little to do with anything we're talking about today, but I guess it's fair that people should know that. I'd like to start with a day that I was in the third grade, the first day I ever realized that there's something seriously wrong with the world. And on this day, in the third grade, I was returning to school at lunch with one of my then best friends, who suddenly elbowed me and said, "Hey, guess what? President Kennedy's been shot in the head, and I hope he dies." That was my introduction to something seriously wrong. I don't think I ever spoke to this kid again.
You were in the third grade when Kennedy got shot? So was I. We're the same age. We didn't even check that out. Hey, no. That's 8 years old, right?
That was, yeah.
Yeah, so I remember that. Yeah, we both remember the day. That was an amazing day, especially having to do with 9/11, because a similar type of cover-up took place.
Right, but I didn't understand that at the time. I didn't know anything except that I found it an incredibly shocking way of being introduced to something that I had not yet believed was really true.
Mm-hmm.
It was only a few minutes later when that truth just crashed down on us all, and it was just unbelievable.
Definitely. So you said your degrees were in geology?
Correct.
Where did you go to school?
I went to the University of Texas at Austin for my undergraduate and for my graduate at Iowa State University.
Mm-hmm. And where are you from originally?
Well, we moved around a lot. But
okay.
We were, you know, Midwestern, Nebraska, Texas, Wisconsin.
Now, et cetera. What was it that brought you to the 9/11 movement? Was it a series of things, or was it like Richard Gage describes hearing Bonnie Faulkner's show Guns and Butter one day, and it just light bulbs went off? I heard Mike Rupert on Bonnie Faulkner's show one day, and my head exploded. You know, lights went off, and I had to get more involved. What about you? What brought you to the 9/11 Truth Movement?
Well, you could say that it's both, but as a geologist, you have to look at it that way. Nobody accuses a volcano of just suddenly going off, but yet that's how it appears to everybody except for a geologist.
Okay.
They see the buildup to this thing. I had met somebody, I had become very interested in the anti-war cause at the time that, you know, when there was a buildup to the Iraq War.
In 2003.
And that was when I first began to experience some peer pressure to look at 9/11. And I wasn't terribly interested in it. I didn't think there was any validity to it at all. But I decided that, you know, in the interest of open-mindedness, I should at least take a look at some things.
Now, you said peer pressure. These friends of yours that were close to you
people,
that said, hey.
People in the anti-war movement when I first started getting involved in it.
Okay.
Just a couple of them, actually.
All right.
But I decided to go ahead and take a look at it with the certainty that it wasn't going to amount to anything, and at least I'd be done with it and I could say so.
What did you look at? What did you first see?
Well, somebody handed me a publication, kind of an amateurish publication, but reasonably well done on the internet, and I thought it was full of holes and other things. But it did lead me to this interest in Building 7, which I'd heard about but never seen. When I finally did manage to download and view the actual collapse event of Building 7, I can tell you that it's like nothing you ever imagined. Like the curtain on reality suddenly crashes down.
Mm-hmm.
Because the collapse itself, although not seen by perhaps a majority of Americans, is unbelievably spectacular only in its ordinariness as a controlled demolition. It looks so much like a controlled demolition that it is all but impossible to imagine that it was anything else, despite the fact that the National Institute of Standards and Technology recently published a 5,000-page report trying to prove otherwise. It has done nothing to make anybody nobody is buying it, mm-hmm. I am aware of.
When I had Richard Gage of the 9/11 Truth Movement on, the director of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, he did 2 hours here about 2 years ago. He mentioned that there's an audio tape out there, and it's on his website, of a FEMA, somebody with a FEMA jacket on, walking up to, and the line of firefighters to get on the pile that day stretched past Building 7, right past the base of it. And apparently this FEMA worker came up and told the line of firefighters that were waiting to get on the pile, you guys got to move because this building is coming down. And he picked up a walkie-talkie, and within minutes, he counted it down, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and sure enough, that building dropped. Now, we never saw that on the mainstream news media, but Richard Gage has that on his website, and there are some definite strange occurrences having to do with Building 7, aren't there?
The building, just the mystery of Building 7 itself is fascinating beyond what anyone would believe. And mm-hmm. I think that most of all, what they don't want people to discover is how fascinating this is. Because even if you're not interested in it from a conscience point of view or, you know, a political thing, if you just like mystery stories, there's nothing like it.
Where did you go from after checking out Building 7? Where did that lead you to?
Let me backtrack a bit, because I want to tell you how my brain processed Building 7 when I first saw it collapse. And remember, this was 2 years after the actual event, so, you know, long time for me to have solidified my belief in the official story.
Mm-hmm.
However, 20 years prior to this, or something like that, I had seen a movie that maybe many people have seen called Koyaanisqatsi, a movie that contained nothing but visual images set to music. And somewhere in that movie, there was about a 5-minute segment that consisted of nothing but building demolitions, one after another. So it was well etched into my brain what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, sometime before the actual 9/11 event, probably another 10 years, I had heard an NPR special specifically targeting building demolitions and how they are accomplished. So, you know, I had had a pretty good introduction into how complicated and technically demanding the science of building demolitions is. So when I saw that building come down, the thought process was, okay, this exactly resembles a controlled demolition according to the movie Koyaanisqatsi. And furthermore, a building demolition is not something you can do on the afternoon that you want to do it. It's something that had to be pre-planned. Therefore, somebody with knowledge that the attacks were coming, for some reason, targeted this building to bring it down on the same day that the other buildings were attacked. That thought process was not a thought process at all. It was just an instantaneous reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And being a great believer in the concept of Sherlock Holmes, I think everybody is a Sherlock Holmes when they are dealing with something they know something about. They instantly go from an observation to a conclusion if it is completely warranted. They don't even think through the thought process that dictates it.
Yeah, if it makes sense.
So for me, instantaneously, that was a powerful piece of evidence. And I thought, you know, it was immediately, I knew there was something seriously wrong with the official story that I had not been willing to acknowledge before. Mm-hmm. And there was no undoing it. I was not going to stand by and wait for somebody else to explain this away, because I knew enough about it to know that you can't explain this away. If you're going to explain 9/11, you better include Building 7, and it better be a controlled demolition. If it isn't, you're lying.
So what did you do then? What happened in your life at that point?
Then I started trying to tell family and friends and others about this, and realized that it meant nothing to them. They apparently weren't coming from it from the same observation and, you know, preconceived knowledge of what it means. So, mm-hmm. you know, I realized then that, A, I had this huge, powerful data point spoke against the official story, and B, nobody was prepared to believe it. What I have since come to understand is that you have to read 3,000 to 5,000 pages of information to understand 9/11 at all, even from the point of view of the official story. It's just a hugely complicated event. But at the same time, we have these very simple pieces of evidence that should be able to sway anybody if they have any knowledge of their physical world around them.
Have you been able to do that? Use those little pieces of knowledge to sway anybody?
Not only will I say yes emphatically to that, but it has the distinct advantage that since 9/11 is a is an issue upon, like a criminal investigation, contingent upon factual data.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if I disagree with somebody ideologically, it's very difficult to persuade them that their ideology is wrong and mine is right, because that's an opinion. But 9/11 has the distinct advantage of being something based on facts. So no matter how right or left somebody is, if they are capable of understanding what a fact is, they can't deny it, and they often, you know, even people I disagree with ideologically and intensely sometimes are often willing to look at, just put aside everything they thought they believed and look at 9/11 in a way that they would not look at anything else. That's why I think it's such a powerful tool in the hands of the very people who were not supposed to know anything about it.
Now, what have you brought to the movement? So you found yourself involved and engaged. I assume you read those 3,000 to 5,000 pages that you talk about, because you speak about it like, you know, you've experienced it. How did you get involved in the movement from there?
Well, once I realized that there was a serious problem with 9/11,
mm-hmm.
then when 9/11 first happened, my first reaction as someone who believes very strongly in the public sector and in environmentalism in general, I thought, well, okay, it's a no-brainer that after this attack, Bush's popularity rating is going to go through the roof, and that's going to give him a license to attack the environment like he's always said he wanted to do.
Sure.
So that was my issue at the time. But once I started to realize that there was something seriously wrong with 9/11, you know, of course, the next thing I realized is, okay, we're playing a completely different ballgame than we thought we were. Talking about, you know, stop the war hurts children, is meaningless in the context of the kinds of psychopaths that could have done this to us. So why should I waste my time, you know, speaking about all the causes that I care about when there's this one thing standing square in the pathway that the lies associated with 9/11 are blocking us from getting anywhere on all the other issues we care about?
Yeah, they really are, aren't they?
I like to think of the 9/11 issue as being the very thing that Tolkien wrote the Lord of the Rings in anticipation of.
Or Orwell wrote, there's so many.
That too, but I'm particularly fond of the Tolkien analogy because in the Lord of the Rings, the only way to destroy the evil power was to destroy the ring. You couldn't do it by winning wars. It didn't work. You had to destroy the ring, and to destroy the ring, you had to take it back where it was born, and that is exactly where we're at with 9/11. It's as if the 9/11 myth that they are living on is their ring of power, and we must all be Frodo's trying to destroy it.
That's a very good analogy. You're hearing from Dana Carson, and Dana, this isn't a paid thing to be in the movement, and I don't need to know what you do for a living, but you make a living for yourself. But in the movement itself, where do you find your place? How do you operate in the movement itself?
Well,
are you kind of on your own?
I'm very much indebted to my colleagues, including the two that you had before me, and mm-hmm. I have great solidarity with all of them. However, I am not instinctively an organizer or a doer or, a creator. I haven't mm-hmm. written any books on this subject, although I think I now have enough information that I could.
Do you find yourself in the movement?
I support and help out where mm-hmm. possible. I often am involved with tabling at events. I often go out on my own and just target the general public with signs and pamphlets and conversations, and I don't know how the term foot soldier on the ground or whatever came about, but and I'll accept it.
That's the way it was described, but I've been trying to get at too. How would you describe yourself?
I suppose as a kind of a guerrilla activist who's just interested in targeting that part of the general public that nobody else considers worth targeting. I'm a big fan of setting up tables in places where nobody is going to believe anything you're saying.
Where have you done that before?
Well, on two occasions, including this recent 4th of July, I had a special federal permit to set up a 9/11 propaganda station, as I'll call it, in Muir Woods National Monument, right at the heart of where all the out-of-town tourist buses must walk right past where our table is, and done all under federal permit.
Now, let's get to that. What, you have to have a permit to have a table there?
That's right.
They have you applied for it.
Right. They have.
Were you open about what the table was going to be about?
Very much so, and they were very supportive.
Really?
In fact, on the first occasion, the park police came up to us after the event and said, "Hey, you guys were great. We only got 25 complaints."
A guerrilla activist, Dana Carson, in the studio with us today. Now, you're going to go to the 9/11 Film Festival this weekend, right?
I'm going to be a part of it. I'll definitely be all day at the Grand, I think, and then a good part of... I'll probably devote some of the weekend to trying to help out with the other events.
Mm-hmm. Since we got a little time, you've probably been to some of the others. This is the 6th annual. Describe what it's like, because I know it's... They dropped Loose Change, the original documentary there, the first edition, and then they went back and cut it, I think, two times after that. But it was first seen by the 9/11 Truth Film Festival right there at the Grand Lake, right?
Yes, I believe that's correct, although I wasn't involved in setting it up. So.
No, but you must have seen Loose Change there. And it must have been a life-changing experience because Loose Change is one of those documentaries. There's more now. But Loose Change is one of those documentaries that really will open your eyes, if you're open at all, to just watch it and listen to what they say.
Yeah, I think that the various iterations of Loose Change, none of which are necessarily refinements, but really almost separate, you know, completely separate documentaries under the same title, more or less. They started out good and only got better. And of course, as they got better, they were subject to more and more ridicule from the mainstream media, from left media, all the media is the same when it comes to this issue. They all censor it. They all ridicule it. They all don't want to be bothered with it. I mean, it's just we just know that we are not going to find, or at least we haven't found, much in the way of mainstream or any other kind of media friends.
Well, that might be an indicator of how real it is. That might tell one that maybe you're on something here because of how vehement the opposition is, bad they want to squelch it.
It's really amazing. And by squelch it, what they mean, what literally is meant here, is that they don't want any of the talking points to get out. They don't want to debate anything. They don't want to win the debate. They want to not have the debate.
Yeah.
It's very much like what would happen if you had a whole auditorium full of well-educated, you know, college students and professors, and there was a debate about creationism versus evolution. The purpose of the people, and I don't want to get into a religious thing here, but since it does concern science and specifically geology, I feel like I am licensed to do so. The creationists will typically try to target an audience of people who are not empowered intellectually to fight against it. But sometimes they're forced to put their debates in front of people who are, and they get trashed. I mean, completely.
Mm-hmm.
The global warming, the same thing. You have global warming deniers who, their target isn't scientists and critical thinkers. Their target is the general public that votes.
Right.
And they want to use innocuous sounding small time talking points to defend a point of view that can't be defended. And boy, it's just way worse in the 9/11 issue.
Mm-hmm.
They use talking points. I want to just, if you don't mind, I want to go into one of these talking points that you hear all the time, because I think it's really important to deconstruct them. One of them is this idea that there would have had to be thousands, man, hundreds of thousands, millions of people involved in the conspiracy. First of all, it's a stupid talking point with no basis in reality at all. Anybody who's really familiar with how intelligence operations work know that a very small handful of people can have a very big influence on events. I mean, I'm not going to go into all the historical examples because you just had that pretty well covered in the past hour and a half. But even if the talking point that, you know, too many people would have had to be involved, even if there was some legitimacy to that talking point, it can't stand alone. It has to stand against the alternative point of view. So if you know, thousands of people had to be involved in keeping the secret of how Building 7 was demolished, and therefore Building 7 wasn't demolished, that has to stand against the overwhelming physical evidence that it was demolished. It's not just that thousands of people would have had to keep a secret. It's also that the secret that they had to keep appears to be independently verifiable, regardless of how many people had to be in on it. So the talking point that thousands of people would have had to keep the secret has to take second place to the talking point that all of the physical evidence appears to support a controlled demolition. And in fact, there is virtually no explanation that can explain it at all other than that.
That's the real troubling thing when you talk to people that are either against the whole idea of 9/11 being a conspiracy. When you talk to people that are against it, they tend to want to ignore the evidence and ignore all these stark things. The Air Force didn't show up. Buildings fall down out of the middle of the sky. The president's in one place, really not calling shots, and the vice president's in the basement of the White House, and he admitted he was calling shots, but yet there's other testimony that he was given mixed signals and all kind of weird orders. And then after all that, we go into this war, and I'm sure in all your studies, you've studied that group that was made up of a lot of folks that ended up in the Bush administration, the new Project for a New American Century.
I've read most of their documentation. Mm-hmm. And yeah, right there. I mean,
they issued that paper just in the summer before 2000, saying we could go take over the Middle East, but the American public won't allow it through public opinion. So the only thing left to do is if a catastrophic Pearl Harbor type event was to take place, that would change public opinion. I mean, these people literally predicted 9/11, didn't they?
Well, they certainly spoke of the inherent advantage if there were a catastrophe widely understood by the public to have originated outside the United States. And let's not forget that Zbigniew Brzezinski also made such a reference in a book called The Grand Chessboard, I believe dating from 1997, in which he claimed, you know, he said that the kinds of, you know, massive changes to our defense policy are only going to be possible in the shadow of a, what did he say, massive and widely perceived direct external threat. I mean, how much clearer can you put it? Okay, but yeah. that all speaks to their need for such an event. That alone would not be confirming proof of anything. But when you put it in light of, you know, that speaks to motive. Motive in a crime is important, but evidence that the crime was committed is even more important.
That's
so
right.
So with or without their motive, we have the evidence.
It's very well spoken. Dana Carson's our guest for the half hour, part of the 9/11 truth movement, an integral part too, as you said, a guerrilla activist, boots on the ground kind of guy. Let's just pretend we're not speaking to the choir right now. Let's pretend we're speaking to people that really don't believe any of this. And what advice, but if somebody was open to, okay, show me, prove to me that what you're saying is true, where would you guide somebody to go, either to read or to watch a video or both or whatever? Where should people go to find out more about this, besides going to the film festival this weekend?
Well, let me just say this about the film festival while you're on the subject.
Yeah.
If you go to the film festival, you're not just going there to see films. You're going there to find the tables of people who are trying to make this information available. Every one of these tables will contain a large number of books written by various authors like Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed, David Ray Griffin. There are a number of others. I won't mention them all.
Mm-hmm.
But read these books. Even if your only reason for reading them is to prove that they have nothing to say, I always like to say the best way to prove that a book has nothing to say is to not read it, because then it didn't say a thing. If you read those books and read, by all means, read the criticisms of the books, read the reviews of the books that are negative, but read the books. Then you'll know what's actually being said instead of somebody else's secondhand talking point.
Mm-hmm.
But I also would like to point out there is so much visual evidence associated with 9/11 that did not exist after the Kennedy assassination. We had the Zapruder film, which was quite compelling.
But, locked up for 50 years.
Right. But 9/11, right on the day it happened, had the image of Building 7 commented on by everyone who was in the media business at the time. Everyone recognized it as a controlled demolition instantly. At that time.
Sure.
It has now since been you know, people are called nuts for thinking that. But that was then.
It dropped in its footprint. You know, a building doesn't fall down like that. And I thought it was so ironic when I found out that the entire paper records of the Securities and Exchange Commission were housed in that building. And when that building went down, it took the records with it with no computer backup at all. And there were major lawsuits going on at that time, especially around Microsoft. Not to implicate Microsoft in any kind of grand conspiracy, no, but they definitely benefited, not just Microsoft, but a lot of people benefited where there would have been lawsuits. And another fact I heard a little while after I first found out all this was that the GAO had done an audit of the Pentagon. It had been ongoing for maybe a year or two. And they had come to the conclusion that the Pentagon was missing something between $2 and $3 trillion that it could not account for. Government money, our money that it had taken, and it could not account for it. And there was going to be a great accounting either on September 11th or the next day or the next week. And when September 11th happened, all that went away and it was never spoken of again. And it's never been raised in the news media or in government circles.
And it's not the only thing that was spoken of on September 10. If my memory is correct, and if I'm not, I apologize, but I believe that George Bush signed the Afghanistan battle plan on September 10th.
Really?
And you'll have to go to other sources to find that. I'm not going to stand by that one. I'm just going to say that is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but definitely to the point. In Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, specifically talks about a speech that Rumsfeld gave. And she doesn't believe that we have anything to stand on the official, countering the official story. But she does make the useful observation that Donald Rumsfeld was in there speaking to a bunch of angry generals and admirals, telling them effectively that their jobs were going to be outsourced, that things were going to be changing in the Pentagon. So, yeah, that plus the $2.3 trillion, all of this stuff that would have angered an awful lot of high-ranking Pentagon officials suddenly swept away the next day. And as Rachel Maddow is so fond of saying, if you want a news story to go away, issue it on Friday afternoon. But on this one occasion, the news story that went away came out on a Monday, September 10, 2001.
Yeah, a lot of stuff got swept under the rug. Dana Carson, you've been our guest for the half hour. I want to thank you for coming in, spending time with us, and I want to thank you for all your hard work. And please do keep it up and keep us posted what you're doing.
Why, thank you. I sure will. And I just want to say that, boy, this is a good education in how short a half hour is.
Want to let you know the views or opinions expressed by the host, DJ, or their guests present on KZSU 90.1 FM Stanford do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Leland Stanford Junior University or its associates. We thank you for tuning in. And there's another hour of this special. Stay tuned because I'm going to air quite a few minutes of the documentary Loose Change. And even though it is a video documentary, the dialogue will help inform. And for as long as we can have the time, I want to air it as a little teaser. It will be aired this Saturday at the Viz Theater in San Francisco. Stay tuned. This is KZSU Stanford.